Hi, I'm Leslie Carrara Rudolph.
I'm Lolly Lard Pop.
And I'm Abby Kid Abby.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
With the Dome.
Sci-Fi Saturday Night. Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
Mass invasion. We'll tell your people to surrender now and avoid war.
Don't think you get me so easily!
It is now time for us to put Earth under our rule.
It's your sacred duty to tell us the truth. Confess, confess that you've been guilty of witchcraft.
You expect me to believe that you can overrun the entire world?
We cannot be defeated. We have never been defeated. That is the message to bring your people.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
From the hot, humid, slimy Venusian sulfur boil massage parlor, next to the underground peekaboo pikachinko parlor and snack bar in Area 51, welcome to TalkCast 354. This edition of Sci-Fi Saturday Night. Tonight, it's Night at the Museum Night, and I'm your host, The Dome. Joining the talk cast, the rest of the gang, in the Peabody Time Tunnel, our technical radical, our button-pushing, keyboard-clacking, sonic screwdrivering, sometimes violent virtuoso. Tonight in the game room, it's Kriana.
What?
I just said tonight in the game room. From the stacks of her quiet place in the Dank Dungeons Manuscript Conservancy, with her advanced degree from the College of Cyborg University at Fresno, friend of the lycanthropic underprivileged, welcome, Zombrarian.
Yeah, this intro is getting away from you, Dome.
Wait, it gets better. You ready for this? A guy walks into an auto parts store and says, I need brake rotors for a 1927 Packard Aardvark. The guy behind the counter looks at him and says, the Packard Aardvark wasn't produced in 1927 because of an acute tin shortage. The man smirks and replies, I know. And at that point, you're in the presence of greatness because it's our very own futurist and gamer, the guy who likes really shiny stuff, Awake by Java.
Completely off the rails, man. Completely.
Thanks. For the past 2 years, our guest has been in the process of building a museum detailing the history of science fiction. A five-hour drive north from London in a Georgian building in Allensdale town, he's building his dream to create a small, permanent museum to share his collection of original props and costumes, original artwork, and his passion for the genre. Over the past year and a half, he's had to become builder, prop restorer, sculptor, curator, researcher, graphic designer, artist, and anything else necessary to get the museum ready for a planned 2018 opening. Joining us on this episode, Neil Cole from the Museum of Classic Science Fiction. Neil, welcome to Sci-Fi Saturday Night.
Hi, that's an amazing introduction. Many, many thanks from the northeast of England.
Well, hey, you know, we did our research. Not much of it, but we actually did it.
That was fantastic. I just want to hear all those jobs I'm doing. That is just lovely. It's sort of recognition, finally.
So, you know, we have a mutual friend, the Belanger brothers, who are very good friends of mine and have gotten to know you as well. And we were sitting down talking about a mutual project that they and I are now working on. And he said, have you heard about Neil Cole? And I went, no, tell me more. And he started to lay out, you know, this whole process of what you've been going through for the past couple of years to get this project moving. And I went, okay, this is like the one-man band museum. And it's really kind of cool. So where did this whole idea for, hey, kids, let's make a museum come from?
It dates, right? You've got to remember what life was like in the 1970s in the UK. This was pre-VHS, and I love Doctor Who. And so you're looking at the
What's
early
90s. VHS?
A VHS, very old, very old thing. I think I can't remember anymore, really. I just know they were there for a while. But I was there. Anyway, the BBC would show. Do you get Doctor Who in the States? Yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, this was, it was very, Doctor Who, you had to be in to watch it, so you'd stop everything, ditch off bikes or whatever you were doing, and you'd get in about and watch your Doctor Who, and you knew that, or you thought, you would never see that episode ever again.
And it turns out half the time you would.
That's right.
Because they erased them.
Very kindly. Absolutely.
How nice of them.
So this was the sort of culture anyway, Saturday nights, and there wasn't a lot of science fiction on. Pre-Star Wars, which I'm old enough to remember, there wasn't very much on. And then there was this little place called Blackpool, which was, about 100 miles from where I am. And they had a Doctor Who exhibition, and this was all the props from that current year, shoved in a really grotty room next to the seaside. But it was just incredible. It was this sort of blurring between fiction and reality. And when you're about five or six, it's better than Santa Claus. Do you know what I mean? It was just amazing.
Absolutely,
And I'd never seen any. Well, I still remember it. And I didn't have a camera, so there's no. It's just all in my head. You know, my family didn't even have a camera then. So
little known fact, they erased that exhibit as well.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's a whole other story. And a lot of my props.
It's dramatic.
It is. They come from a lot of the exhibits I had come from those exhibitions. So anyway, that was I always just loved that idea. And then over many, many years, I started collecting and sculpting, and then became an art teacher, then started building props at school, Daleks and what have you. And again, there was a shortage of merchandise. You know, I mean, nowadays the kids, they look at me really weird half the time anyway, because I'm fairly weird, but they look at me and they don't understand that, you know, having a Cyberman helmet or something was just like, would have been incredible. I mean, we used to build stuff out of cardboard boxes, you know, and just pretend, you know, and, you know, just to sort of then gather props together. This just became a passion and started to, am I going on here? There was an auction.
No, you're fine.
There was an auction in the early 1990s in Bonhams in London. And this was an incredible event because I had no money. I was really poor. But I just remember seeing all these costumes were going for sale. And it was on a program called Blue Peter here, which is a big children's show. And it was just, wow, these things actually are real. It was almost like these props didn't exist for real. You know, they were sort of in some sort of bizarre dimension. And suddenly these things were on sale. And at the time, I was heartbroken because there was no way I was ever going to get them. You know, these were for other people. And then eventually I became a teacher and I started to realize that they were out there and there was more auctions over time. And the prop building community now is quite big. I was fortunate in that I got into it before it became really crazy and dealer driven. And I always got into it because I loved the items. It was never about the money. Whereas now it's almost become for a lot of people, I think, a financial thing.
It's become horribly commercialized now for almost everything.
Yeah, and it's a shame, really, because, there's a very famous film director in New Zealand who loves Doctor Who, and a lot of the original 60s items now are in New Zealand. And the question is, will we ever see them again? And what I guess I wanted to do was get these old props, starting with Doctor Who, and get them out to people again. And also the BBC just didn't look after them. I've spent the last 2 years repairing things. Luckily, it's been like one of these projects where I can sort of put everything I've ever done ever, from even just from teaching and talking to people and, you know, sculpting and God knows what, you know, everything together, and I can sort of apply it to this crazy project.
So let's talk for just a little bit about, okay, so you have this wonderful passion, and it's a passion that, as I look around my office in Area 51, I can well understand.
Yeah, I'm sure you can.
And now you have this place called the Osborne House in Allendale Town.
Yeah.
And did you own this house? Is this your house? Did you buy this house?
Yeah, it was a lot of a big bit of luck there. excuse me, we were living in a tiny little, we'd call it two up, two down over here. In other words, it was a little, very old 1600s mining cottage, my partner and I. And we had some children, and I had monsters And this house was so small. And then my friend, who has a coffee shop a few miles away, said, "I'll store your monsters for you in my cellar, in his basement." And then I had to put others elsewhere.
For a minute, you were talking about your children. I was like, "That's not nice."
Well, do you know what? It's a tempting thought. I started having monsters all over Northumberland, and I realized I was going to sell everything. And then one day we saw this house, to cut a long story short, and we thought it was like a Gothic horror house. We turned up at night, it was the rain, and it was the lightning and rain, I kid you not. And we both came out and went, "Wow, you know, that is just the most horrible house we've ever been in terms it's quite scary, really." And it had been unloved. And we went back a couple of times, and it was just this base. It's a cellar, but it's ground floor, and it's in a marketplace. And it was just it all started to fit together. And then we got it for a crazy amount of money, very, very reasonable. And it needed a lot of work, but I worked as a builder many years ago, and I'll do anything really. And suddenly it was like, I've got the collection. There's the building. This could actually possibly happen, and that's where it all sort of came together.
So then there's not only, okay, so you've got a spot, you've yep. got some of the stuff you want to put in it, and you've got the government to deal with and all the permitting and all the,
yeah,
that had to drive you crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons, there was various houses that, you know, you could see which had the space. But it was the fact that it had to be, if it was too residential, they would never have let me open it. Because there would have been sort of science fiction folk popping around, you know, as you're sitting in your garden, you can imagine coach loads and things. So it had to be somewhere that was public, which this was. And then it took me about a year and a half to get all the permits. And this is, it's called a listed building here. And because it's Georgian, it's original. It meant that I wanted TARDIS doors on the front of the building. They wouldn't let me have them. And it wasn't because of the structure of the TARDIS door they didn't like, which I think are very attractive doors anyway. No, it was the fact that they said that the blue was not Georgian blue. And they said that the Georgians didn't have much blue paint. At which point I wanted to say, we need a time machine to go and check this out, because I cannot believe that some Georgian buildings did not have blue doors, because blue is a very old pigment in art history, as I'm sure you may be aware. But it was just, it's those sort of little things that do annoy somewhat.
So now you've got a building, you've gotten many of the permitting that you need to make this happen. Now you've got to change this rather old, unwieldy structure into a museum.
Yeah.
And I've got to admit, I've been on the website a lot,
yeah,
and I've seen kind of the floor plan and the build diary, and there's some very interesting stuff there. I'm amazed at what it looked like when you first started out.
I am so pleased that you've taken the time to look at that. I do wonder, because people say to me regularly, are you not open yet? And I feel like saying, am I not open yet? Have you any idea of what I'm having to do? I mean, if I had a squadron, you know, of builders to help me on this, it would be amazing. I've had to restore the stonework back to its original condition. The beauty of it is that I think once you've got LED lighting and you put futuristic props against this stonework, and it looks amazing. You know, I've got one of the it's not a great film, but you know, the Thunderbird 2 flight chair, which I traveled halfway across across the UK to get, but you get that in lit against this stonework and it just looks fabulous. And I think it's all going to pay off, you know. I think the beauty of the lucky thing now is that LED lighting is so cheap and it's safe, it's cool, and you can just really arrange lights. It's almost like a rock show almost now, which, you know, even like 20 years ago, you'd have had huge hot lamps and it would have been a far more difficult project to do. But I'm so glad you looked at the build diary, because it's been a beast. I mean, when we moved in, it was a pond. The bit you can't see, which I never got photographs of, was there was literally a pond. There was water just coming in the back wall. And there's a secret room, which is probably, again, it'll be 300 years old, and it was buried. And there was people's shoes and stuff in there. And that's, it's
oh,
just
good Lord.
Yeah, and there was actually a 1950s kids painting set with a robot, you know, like a classic pulp sci-fi robot painting on it. It all rotted away, and I wished I could have sort of preserved it. And it was just all buried underground. You know, it was just the most bizarre, wonderful, though, you know, exciting place.
And there's you scurrying around on scaffolding, and a young girl chipping away at the wall there.
Oh, that's my daughter. That's my daughter Matilda. She's just amazing. I've got two children, but Matilda is. Yeah, she just thinks it's amazing. She just wants to help all the time. I just wish she was about another sort of 5 or 6 years older. Then I could actually physically get her actually, you know, slaving away like a Dalek slave for me, you know. Amazing. And she looks at the monsters, you know, upstairs in the loft. I've got all the monsters upstairs on the fourth floor. And she goes and sits and talks to them. And there's like, there's part of the alien, you know what I mean, up there. And she's just like, doesn't bat an eyelid. I just think it's quite funny.
Perfect.
Wait, You've raised her to them?
Oh, yeah, she talks to them. She loves them.
Oh, that's the cutest thing I think I've ever heard.
She takes My Little Ponies, which she's got, and she takes them upstairs, and she arranges them around, like, the skitters of Falling Skies and things like this. She loves that because she's got the hands. You know, the claws have got big finger extensions. She was sort of wandering around with those on with My Little Pony. And I thought, wow, that's just the strangest thing ever,
Tell
really.
Tell me she, like, has tea with them and stuff.
Yeah, she does. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's funny because there was a photograph. I got a casting. Sadly, I haven't got the money to get an original C-3PO. Very few people will have, I suspect. But I got a nice casting of the body pieces from an original source. And I set them all down in the cellar. And then Matilda went down the cellar and a friend photographed it. And so there was this sort of body of C-3PO and sort of raw fiberglass in amongst the rubble. And then just Matilda smiling in a summer dress. And my friend just said, that is a nightmare, isn't it? That looks like something off one of these films with a little girl coming out the haunted. You know what I mean? It was just, that sort of place. That's, you know, it's that sort of place.
I'm looking at your floor plan.
Yes.
And you're shoving an awful lot of stuff into this place. My goodness.
I've changed the floor plan. I'm going to update that at some point. Do you want me to talk about the floor plan? Because this
absolutely.
This has given me a massive, massive headache because I'm sort of part librarian, you know, in my mind. I love, you know, I've got all my sci-fi flicks and series all arranged by genre and subgenre and all this. And when I came to do the floor plan, it was really difficult because you think, well, okay, I'll do it by subgenre, you know, so it'd be like dystopian fiction. Which I love dystopia, good dystopian fiction. You know, so dystopian, then you've got like time travel. Then you get things like The Terminator, where you're thinking, okay, well, that's time travel, but it's dystopian, but it's also a bit robotic. It's like, oh, God, so where's that go? And it started to really spin my mind. And so what I've decided to do, I'm changing it completely. The best way of doing it, there was a book, Guy Haley or something. It's a history of science fiction. I think Stephen Baxter wrote a foreword for it, and my partner got me it for my birthday. And it's a wonderful book, and it's a chronological history of science fiction, year by year. So when you sort of reach, for example, The Terminator, it'll handle all the sequels and everything else at that point in the timeline. And I thought, hallelujah, this is the way to do it. So the museum's going to start with H.G. Wells, who I adore H.G. Wells. And he really did, I don't know what you guys think, but totally create the genre for me personally. You think about all those books like, you know, got Moreau and, you know, sort of evolution and tampering with that. And you've got the time machine. You've got the alien invasion with all the worlds. You've got the invisibility. You've got so many things he did. So he's going to be sort of the hub at which it starts with and then move through chronologically into the pulps and various things. And so it will actually be chronological now. So it won't be grouped as it was on that time, on that thing, to avoid this sort of the over-cross-laps between subgenres are so incredible when you start getting into it.
It's all kind of a spiderweb at that point anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, because you look at what begat what and what was influenced by who, and by the time you're done, you're sitting in the corner and everything is just strewn around you.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. So it was like, I mean, Terminator was the classic example of what exactly is it? Do you know what I mean? What genre is it really? Because it's a big time travel story, isn't it? But it's also about technology, and it was just. And so I thought, right, there's got to be a better way. And this book is wonderful if you haven't got it. And I'm sorry, I haven't got it right beside me, but it's a great handbook. And I just loved the way it had, you know, you get to Star Wars and it deals with everything Star Wars. So in, you know, 1977, everything, the prequels, everything you've got is in one place. I thought, that's how I can do it. So in my small space, I can just work my way through this nice little timeline. It's great fun, you know, sort of visualizing it all. So Planet of the Apes, for example, I've got an original ape costume, which I was delighted to get. I know there's a few around, but I've got one from 1970. And
from the original movie.
Yeah, and I can put that with, you know, the Tim Burton costume I've got. And that's okay, because that's where, you know, that's celebrating that moment in sci-fi. So that's going to make life a lot easier. And then the second half of the museum is going to be the history of classic Doctor Who. And I do say classic because that's really where I'm at. I think just my age, getting old and grumpy. I just love the original run. And it also makes it life a lot easier for collecting. I can just, and what I'm trying to do with the Doctor Who side is take one object per classic story. So it's like a history of the world in 100 objects kind of thing. It's like a history of Doctor Who, classic Doctor Who, one object per story, which is quite a nice way of telling it. So it's going to be like an episode guide through props and published illustrations. So that's the thinking behind it.
And part of what you're bringing through with that is, and of course, right now the webpage just locked up on me, is the artwork of Andrew, and I've lost his last name.
Andrew Scaletta.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Yeah. I apologize.
Are you familiar with his work over there?
I don't know how familiar people are, but in looking at your descriptions and stuff, I realized that was part of the Classic Who series, that artwork in his books. And I guess it was also on the videotape cases as well.
Yeah, it was very much, again, going back to those early experiences, it was the Target books. Again, I'm sure you'll have had them over there, but the Target books were the only way you got to see, you got to sort of mentally see Doctor Who again. And they were massive for people over here, that, you know, you the Doctor Who, as far as you were aware, the show was never going to be shown again. And there was all sorts of, there's whole books being written just about that. But the Target books were just like, you know, the covers were like the movie poster for each story. And they were just fabulous. And I remember me and my friends, we'd collect these books. And Andrew did a lot of, he's the artist who did the most number of covers. And then he got into the VHS covers. And there are other artists who contributed very much as well. But Andrew's work I really loved. And there was a couple of key texts in the 1980s where he did the first sort of big coffee table histories, which were sort of with these beautiful airbrushed artworks. And I got to know Andrew because I'm an artist as well, and he supported my art, which was incredibly kind of him and amazing. It was amazing to find somebody who...
Well, that was kind of my next question was, how did you get all this amazing artwork?
From Andrew himself, it was simply eBay. There was a little sketch. You see, I am still incredulous at how I've got some of the things I've got, because I, honestly, you know, I come from this little tiny place up northeast of England, and I wasn't sort of where all the sort of happening, you know, it wasn't like being in London, you know, where all these exhibitions were. But the internet, I think, was a huge thing. Clearly the internet was a huge thing, understatement of the world. But just having, you know, just I bought this little book illustration, which I recognized, and I just thought it was some guy who managed to get it. And I knew immediately it was the original thing. And I looked online, I thought, is that Andrew selling it? And I just went, you know, in my sort of best fan voice, hello, are you Andrew Scaletta by any chance? I love you, sort of thing. And he went, yes, it's me. And then after that, we started talking, and he sold me that bit of work. And then he said, I've actually got a few more pieces. And then we just started. I said, could I send you just some of my artwork to look at in a bold moment? And he was lovely and took a real interest. And after that, we just corresponded. And he's so behind the museum. And I'll be able to sort of be nice to showcase permanently some of his work. And I've got this beautiful set of paintings he did for it was a USA tour in the 20th anniversary of Doctor Who. And there was a big truck. Some people listening may have even seen this. It was a huge truck was sent over from Britain, and it was full of Doctor Who monsters, a couple of which are now going to be here in this museum. And he did this beautiful trailer art, which was then sprayed up onto this truck. And it went across the States. And I've got all his preliminaries and paintings for that. And that's just it was just fabulous getting that sort of work. And it blew me away. You know, I mean, the thing is, I love this stuff. It's, you know, as I say, I read a lot, I'm on a lot of forums, and people are going on how much this is worth and how much that's worth. It really is not that for me at all. Obviously, you have to pay things out, but it is very much, it's this passion, you know, this is the child in me. The fact that I'll be able to share it with everyone, that's the amazing thing. You know, the thought of this stuff being stuck in a room somewhere, I just don't get that, you know, and it's just such a shame that stuff is just never going to be seen, you know, and this stuff will be seen, hopefully, by as many people as possible.
Well, on top of that, you've also got Andrew commissioned to create brand new illustrations just for the museum.
Yeah. I mean, this is where Andrew's just been absolutely amazing. He's just, he's, you know, but again, because of his connection with Doctor Who, what I was thinking is like any, you know, the 1960s is a black zone in terms of props and original pieces. I have a few scraps from the 1960s. There are pieces out there, but these are huge money, you know, ticket items. So I thought one of the nicest ways of doing this would be to get, you know, Andrew, because he's got an established history with the show, to fill in some of the blank stories there. I mean, I'm an artist as well, so I'm going to do little bits and pieces. But ultimately, Andrew's got that connection with the show. He worked with a production team in the 1980s in closely producing portraits of the actors and the monsters and creatures and things. And so to have Andrew, and Andrew will, you know, he's amazing. He will just, you know, you ring him up and say, will you do this, that, and so then he's just, what do you want, Neil? How would you like me to do this? And of course, being an artist as well, it's really nice. So we can sort of talk about it. It's amazing. It is actually talking to you now makes me realize how amazing this is. Do you know what I mean?
It's kind of cool when it all comes together like that,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had two artists who sort of really inspired me as a child. One was Andrew, and the other was Giga, you know, who did Alien.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, clearly, because it was just, to me, Giga was the, you know, the unspoken artist, you know, sort of like one of our true voices of original art in the last century and into this century. And he never gets it. He always just like, oh, he's the guy who did Alien. But he's the most incredible, unique artistic vision. And I don't know why I've digressed on that, because I've got nothing in the museum of his, and I'd love to. So if anyone's listening to this and would like to donate, please do. Sorry, I'll let you go. I'll come off on that one.
So one of the other things that I thought was rather interesting that you've had to force yourself to learn is restoration.
Yeah. Of the prop.
The prop restoration, because props are, you know, they're made to look right, not necessarily feel right and survive.
Yeah.
And your job is to take that thing that looks right and make sure that's going to look right in 6 months or 6 years.
Yes.
I loved on the website your restoration page of the thing's head from Fantastic Four. Yeah. How the hell did you get that?
That was just there are, once you start looking into props, there are many, many auctions where studios are clearing off set. You know, when you think about how many costumes and props are made per production, it's massive. Things like The Thing, there was I don't know, probably something like 40 prosthetic heads made for The Thing. So it's the one I have is a Scream used hero one. You know, we use the term hero, meaning it was, you know, on Michael Chiklis, or however you pronounce him. It's not like chickpea. Sorry, I don't know exactly how you pronounce Mr. T. If he's listening, I'm sorry. But, you know, so there was, you know, eventually, I guess they've got so many of these things, they now sell them off, and there is an established market for it. And there are certain auction sites, and they just deal with, you know, liquidation of sets. And they're great places if anyone's listening and wants to get into collecting props. That is a really good place to go to. A little bit of searching online, you'll find that. Doctor Who's a different matter in terms of getting them, because it's literally a lot of production members still have bits and pieces, and that's a much more protracted process. But nowadays, in terms of American, particularly productions, where you've got shows all the time closing and getting rid of things. So for me, I look at a show that I like Falling Skies. I just got into late in the day. I'm very late in the day. I tend to watch everything, you know, a couple of years after it's been on. Anyway, and I'm watching The Strain at the minute. I bet that's been on for years, has it? So that's a question there to anyone. So what tends to happen is with props is that they're not designed to last. And the thing is made of, you know, foam latex. And pretty early on, about 15 years ago, I did my first sort of, it was a Davros head from Doctor Who. And I knew if I didn't do something with it, it was not going to last. The BBC have just let things fall away. It's horrendous, really. So I just started experimenting with resins and acrylic sprays and things and doing a bit of research. And really, it's finding out what doesn't react with the rubber. And you need to get it onto something so that the piece doesn't move anymore. And the thing one was a good one because it's a beautiful piece. Sorry. Hello.
It's really funny. And going through your narrative of how you put the thing together, there were moments that you could actually feel as reading this, that you were actually panicked. How do I get this head to stabilize against the foam of Michael Chiklis' yes. head? And yes. then the other one was inserting the eyes into it.
Yeah.
Making the decision that had to happen.
Yeah, because I had this, it was on a lovely, really nice live cast of Michael Chiklis. And on the one hand, you're thinking, wow, that's a really nice live cast of Michael Chiklis. But then you think, well, okay, it's a thing that I want to see, obviously, ultimately, and people do too. The beauty of that was, in the old days, they would have been on plaster cast busts, which would have been a real pain. I've got one or two, and they're literally like boulders, you know, they're horrendous things to work with. But with the new foam cast, they're sort of like a light foam, like builder's polyfoam. And you can just literally carve them out. But it was just the fact that I was going to desecrate a life cast, which in itself was quite nice. I think that's where, you know, years of sculpting and art has come in. Really handy, because I'll be honest, again, this is, I take it for granted because I've always done things like this for very little money. But there are people charge a lot of money now for that sort of thing. I mean, it's skilled work. I don't want to sort of sing my own. You know, I'm not trying to sort of.
Well, yeah, it kind of is, don't you think?
But you know what I mean? It is skilled work. And there's people, you know, there's a whole business now out there in restoring props. So if you buy a prop and you want it displayed properly and everything else, but you can pay often more for the display and the restoration now, you know, for props worth, say, 500, $500 or whatever you would call it. What's the word? Bucks? I'll say dollars. Trying to sound cool there and like I know what I'm talking about. But yeah. £500, if it was 500 over here, you know, you'd be paying probably about at least 1,000 to get it put on a stand. Now, when you're trying to do a museum, that's just not possible. So, you know, anything I can do, I'll do it myself. And so the key thing with like the thing was get it stable, stop it moving. I think I covered it in a resin, which toughens it up. Now, some people might go, no, not resin, but it doesn't react with the surface. And it's a bit like, I always think it's a bit like, you know, the little insect in Jurassic Park. You're sort of putting it in amber and trying to stop the air and oxygen and everything else getting to it. And then once you've got it on that, you can then sort of sculpt into it. I mean, again, what you're trying to do is preserve the original piece. And some restoration now, and I've had to think about this myself, goes too far. You end up producing a new object, which ceases to be. You can lose something of the original thing too much. And I wish I had a picture here to show you, because I've got this mask from Doctor Who I'm doing now. And a couple of people who actually worked on Doctor Who contacted me and said, don't paint this bit of mask I'm working on now. So leave the bit you've sculpted white, because then we can see the original surviving piece. And then your new area shows the visitor, you know, what it would have looked like, you know, 30 years ago. And gives an impression of what it would look like, but it also shows which are the original pieces that actually appeared in the actual show. And that's been a really interesting new approach. But like the thing, I just went for it, you know, put the eyes in, because I wanted to see what the thing looked like, you know what I mean, with eyes open, you know.
So the question is, how much of it is actually restoration and how much of it is actually preservation?
Yes.
You know, and there's a fine balance there that you have to be careful of.
Yeah, and I think with certain props, certainly like the Doctor Who props, is very is quite hard because there's often just one of it. You know, like the thing, as I say, there's several people got thing busts out there, and there was quite a few of them made. And you know, it was you know, it's like in production, you put a prosthetic on and you literally throw it away, you know, and then next shoot, you know, next prosthetic sort of thing. People like me try and grab those and then sort of like try and preserve them, you know, instead of letting them go in the bin. But with the Doctor Who pieces, there was, you know, not the budgets that you've got on sort of film things. So you would have one prop made with a lot of time and effort, like this mask I'm looking at right now, and that's it. That is the mask. So if I do anything radically, and if I start sculpting all over it or whatever it is, which I could do, I could arguably make it look better than it could do. Do you know what I mean? But you start to cross into that borderline. Well, actually, it's no longer the mask it was. And so that, as I've gone into this project now, it's you know, the key thing is to stop those materials like rubber and things like that. Stop it, them falling to bits. I mean, it's horrific. The BBC exhibitions, there was a character called the Garm in a Peter Davison's story called Terminus. And I loved the Garm. He was he's a joke character, really, because he doesn't do very much. And he got big red eyes, looks like a big dog, and just sort of lumbers around. But I just thought it was wonderful, sort of B-movie kind of character. I used to see him every year in the Blackpool Museum, and I used to see him deteriorating. And first of all, one arm went, and then you could see the rubber was stripping off, and then by the time it went to auction in 2010, its other arm had gone. And then somebody bought it, where I actually then got it a couple of years later, and the guy who got it had put it in a sunlit prefab room, being bathed in sunshine. He had loads of monsters, right? And he had about four or five classic monsters. These are sort of sci-fi history, just dying in the sunshine. He was clueless, absolutely clueless. I mean, with all respect, he didn't know. And I couldn't afford them all. I just got that one. And, you know, now I've managed to preserve every bit of rubber that came off that I picked up off that floor. I have sealed. And what I'll probably do with that one is I will re-sculpt the arms from scratch, and I'll present them with the original surviving pieces beside it, because it was so damaged, the arms, you know, that they're really, you know, there's no way I'm going to actually be able to put them back into the figure.
It was really interesting looking at the thing, in that the decision you made to stabilize it against the life cast and then actually put the blue eyes into it and then restore around the eyes afterwards. I'm so glad you did that, by the way.
Oh, it's
because it's a much more vibrant piece with the eyes and the restoration around them.
Oh, thank you.
What was the deal with the teeth?
Well, the thing with that piece is, I love that. I mean, I love the thing. I love Marvel. That's another section in the museum, by the way. There's going to be a Marvel section. I learned to read with Marvel comics. You know, I didn't have books. I didn't read books till I was probably about 10 or something. It was just Marvel every week. Marvel comics, Spider-Man weekly. It was just so to get the thing was a big moment. I just couldn't believe it. You know, the teeth. I got the teeth as well. They are Michael Chiklis's screen-worn teeth. And they're huge. I have got a picture, which I will put on my site at some point, of me wearing them at school. I actually gave a lesson with them in one day, and they're huge. These are big teeth. I mean, he's a big man, I think, by the look of it. He's bigger than me, and then these teeth are big for him, and they just look amazing when you wear them. Anyway, I did think about it. Should I put the teeth in? The problem is I would have had to really carve up the face. And in a way, from a display point of view, I just thought it would be quite nice to show them as the separate piece of the makeup they are, rather than sort of carve up that mouth area. But that actual mouth, that thing face, is a series of pieces. You know, it's the sort of classic hero prosthetic. You know, you've got the mouth area, the nose separate, the brow separate. And the reason I sculpted in around those eyes was because I'd have had to stretch the latex, the foam, and pin it. And now over a few years, that was going to tear. So two people said, you shouldn't have sculpted as much in around the eyes. You know, you haven't. I said, yeah, but what I needed to do was leave the rubber really relaxed, so it wasn't stretched and tense, you know. And then it was artistic license. I mean, it was a bigger area than, you know, would have been on the original mask. So I just sort of used a bit of license on it. And I think, yes, I'll be honest, I am pleased with it. But it's not as screen accurate, you know, as
right.
As
but it's a great decision from an aesthetic point of view that it really gives the mask the attention to the detail that you wanted it to have.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really pleased that you're the first person who's really complimented that, and I greatly appreciate that somebody's actually taken the time and seen what I've done to it. So thank you very much. Some people have no idea, you know. Here's me moaning. This is me in England moaning. Some people have no idea what I do. They just don't understand, you know. But yeah, no, thank you. It's a super mask. I mean, I always want to just do the pieces justice, you know. I mean, there's some makeup, you know, maestro out there who sculpted that. And I always think, my goodness, one day they might walk in and see something I've done to their work, you know. And you just want to do the best you can with the piece. And that's the other thing about the museum is it's very much about celebrating the people who made the masks, wrote the stories. It's very much about the ideas. You know, you go to conventions and things, which I haven't gotten to many, but you go to and it's very much actor-driven. I don't know what you find over you know, in the States, but there's a heavy drive towards actors. And that's great. They're wonderful.
It's happening kind of that way now.
Yeah, well. And yeah. I want to reflect the guys who do the ideas and the craftsmen. And I guess because I'm an artist person myself, and I drew comics as well, bits and bobs. I love the art side of it. So it's a celebration, obviously, of the actors, but it's the unsung people that I want to really push to the fore. You know, and starting with writing, and then into the people who make these things real that the actors can act with, because without that. You know, it wouldn't be the same.
So how important was it for you as a child? Mm. You know, you said Marvel Comics were your kind of entrance key into this whole universe.
Yeah.
How important was that to you? And did you ever, like, get tired of them? Or were you one of those people who, as you grew up, you just kept on with it?
Well, I mean, basically, I was the archetypal bullied kid. I know it's like it's a cliche. I really was. I look back in my life and I was hammered. My God. You know, I was really, I just disappeared. I was an only child as well, so I didn't have any brothers and sisters to back me up, but I had a really good friend up the road, and he would eventually go down and what we would sort of subtly call kick in people. If somebody really got to me, eventually my friend would come around and kick them in, which means take them out and give them a jolly good hiding. Anyway, which was very satisfying, but that's a different subject. But yes, so I would disappear into this world. And again, in the 70s in the UK, it was your sci-fi fix was Doctor Who on a Saturday night. That was a regular fixture, but it was half an hour. Kids these days just don't know. They're born with all box sets and everything else, really. You know, you had this half an hour, so you'd and then it was the Saturday morning, you'd go with my dad to the local newsagent, and you'd get, there was no American comics. There was American comics a little bit, but it was the reprints, the UK reprints, which were serialized the American comic books into smaller chunks. And I would disappear with, you know, they just, it set my world alight. And then I was very lucky with, my dad would let me stay up late and watch. Occasionally we'd get B-movies and The Outer Limits, they showed once, the original 60s series. That,
oh, yeah.
Had such a huge impact on me, that series. I mean, I adore it to this day. And it doesn't, in this country, there's not as much, not many people know about it. It was put on in a late night slot over here, but I was lucky enough to stay up and watch it. And it never left me that. And I've got a script from that. That was one of my favorite things. I managed to get a script, an original script from it. But anyway, yeah, in the 80s, I got into rock music and started off with, you know, Kiss and that kind of thing. And then I got into serious music. Like, I ended up in a Rush tribute band doing the Geddy Lee stuff and wanted to be a musician. And at that point, I still watched Doctor Who, but I stopped all sort of collecting. And, it was typical, but I never got rid of stuff. And then very quickly, as I came out of that, realized I just loved it. And then it was like, then I think the next thing I did when I sort of hit my 20s was build a Dalek, as you do. Because again, Daleks weren't commercially available. I mean, man, I wanted a Dalek so bad. I mean, you know, it was almost like, what do you want more, Neil? A girlfriend or a Dalek? A Dalek or a girlfriend? Dalek or a girlfriend? You know, this was a big decision. Do you know what I mean? And I'll be honest, it was
a tough
call. Anyway, eventually I managed both. But, you know, I'm making a Dalek. That was probably my pathway into getting into sci-fi art project in a more complex way, where there was more of a challenge as a maker of things, because it was just you could really actually make something you'd seen on screen and make it look like it was the real thing. That was quite thrilling for a while. And that was before I got into the original props, because again, I just didn't think that was ever something that was accessible to somebody like me. If you told
so
me,
were
I was
you
gonna,
going to art yeah. school at the same time? Were you going to art school?
Oh, I went to art school. Very briefly, I left and I hated it. I was just, I was an idiot. Basically, when I say an idiot, I was just silly. I still am a bit silly, really. But which is why some of the children quite like me, I guess. But it's just I was a bit crazy at the time. And fine art left me cold, if I'm honest. When I say fine art, I mean, you know, sort of the fine art of the period up here, the modern fine art up here. It was a funny, I remember going in and they weren't interested in painting skills or drawing. I'm sure you know this sort of thing. It was all conceptual art. And at the time, I think my sort of 19-year-old head just wasn't there. I wanted to build Daleks and paint things and do Roger Dean landscapes and that kind of thing, which wasn't in vogue, really. So I left and sort of was self-employed as an artist for a little bit, drawing people's dogs and houses until I got absolutely, I didn't want to see a dog or a house again. And then went back and I studied, believe it or not, I studied astrophysics and because I loved astronomy. I always think astronomy and science fiction are sort of close cousins. There's always that sort of cross. I remember Carl Sagan's Cosmos. That was another big thing. That sort of, I don't know how big that show was in America. I would imagine fairly big.
Huge,
short.
Absolutely
yeah.
huge.
Yeah, well, that blew my mind. Cosmos and Vangelis, you know, the music, the combination. And I always thought, God, I'd love to study cosmology, you know. So I ended up having a funny old thing. And I ended up teaching anyway, where I sort of taught a bit of science and art and things like that. So it's been a funny old twisty turny path. And play a bit of music from time to time still, you know.
So
I've digressed there, sorry.
At? No, great digression. I'm fine with that. So you've got your space, you've yeah. got your monsters, you've yeah. got your exhibits, you're working yeah. on putting your space together.
Yeah.
Well, where are you at? What do you need? What are you looking for right now?
Well, it's been a funny month or two because I shouldn't say, but there's nothing to say I can't. There's a TV program over here which would be wonderful. It's looking really positive that it could go ahead. And it's one of these shows where they, you know, they take a building and they show people change the building. And the key focus of this program, it's a new program if it comes off, and they're very keen to have me on it, is it's basically where people have got an ordinary looking house on the outside and there's something incredible happening inside it. Now, if I get that, filming could start very soon. So what I'm having to do, I'm just having a quick drink.
No, we all are. No problem.
Yeah. So if that happens, what I'm working to a little sort of schedule now. I basically need electrics, like an electrician to come and give me a hand. A wood floor put down to protect the listed floor. And, you know, once you've got that in, it's getting quite close. And I'm launching a Kickstarter in October, which a few people have encouraged me to do. And I was going to launch it a couple of months ago, but I stopped because apparently the summer time's a really bad time for crowdfunding because everyone goes on holiday.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought... it's funny because I don't like asking for money. I'm not that sort of person who sort of wants to go and ask. But, you know, I think a lot of people said, no, it'd be nice. People will probably want to contribute and, you know, sort of become members of the museum. And so I thought, okay, we'll give it a go, because what that would do, it would enable me to get a few, you know, just some building expertise in to do a few final bits. I'll do everything myself, but it's speed. You know, I'm not a fast joiner. You know, I will do some joinery. Absolutely. But if I get that, I could be open in spring. If I got the crowdfunding, it would just speed it up. So really we're looking at a bit of a rewire downstairs, because you can imagine all the LEDs and things that need to go in.
Oh, sure.
The wood floor is it's to stop people. If I let people walk in at the minute, it's an uneven floor. But I'm in this funny situation where the floor is listed. It's part of the listed features of the building. So, and these are huge plinths. So you can't, to lift them, these are huge. They're like sort of small cars, you know. There's no way I'm going to lift those. So I thought the easiest thing is to put a floating floor on, make a nice even surface that's safe for people to walk on. And then it's a question, I'm going to build sort of stud walls with MDF and put, you know, I'll not bore you with the detail on that, but so I can inlay certain items into the actual wall. I've got animation cells and things, you know, and I thought they all go nicely in and separate the actual cell from the background painting. If you can kind of imagine that.
Sure.
So you can see, so I've got some, you remember Filmation's Flash Gordon from 1970?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I've got some animation cells from that, and I just thought it'd be really nice to separate the cell from the actual painting. So, you know, there's so many things. I mean, it's such a fun thing to think. This is where Mike's little creative side goes into overdrive, but that'll be the fun bit. So really, once I get that done, it's a lot of work in that. And I'm also writing plaques as I go. Basically what I'm going to do is part of the crowdfunder is if you donate a small amount or an amount, you'll be getting a plaque, which will have a prop. The research I've written about the prop, and it'll be sort of dedicated to you, you know, as your prop in the museum. So it's like
very nice. I'm
glad you like that. And I thought of Sponsor a Monster. I thought that was quite fun. You know, where basically, you know, you get, if you put a bit more in, you'll get a big monster with your name on it. And it just means that, you know, people sort of, and I don't want, I'm going to have to charge for entry simply because if I'm in the museum, I'm not earning a living elsewhere, you know, teaching. I intend to sort of work part-time as a teacher, sort of 3 days a week teaching and sort of 3 days a week all year round here and all through all holidays open all the time. Because the key thing is I don't want, you see a lot of small museums open and people throw their entire lives into them because they're generally passion projects like this. But you've got to make them work, and it's no good sort of quitting all your financial avenues down and then it all folding. There was a lovely dinosaur museum in the Lake District, not far from here. And it was great. And it only lasted 6 months. And I think the guy, bless him, and I really felt for him, he'd thrown everything into it, you know, and quit his day job and everything else. And it's, you know, they're difficult things to keep going. So the way I'm approaching this is that I'll work part time, cover the main bills with my teaching, and then build on the museum over several years. And I want to get signings, you know, happening here. I'm very lucky. I'm next to a little art center and coffee shop, so I can host events over there as well. And because it's a little village, everyone's really supportive and we all support each other. And it's, you know, it's sort of that lovely sort of hub feeling. And so I want to get, I'd like to get one of the Doctor Who's in to open it.
How wonderful would that be?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it'll be one of the classic Doctors. I met a couple of them. But I just think, you know, it'll definitely be, you know, there'll be I had a guy contact me yesterday, offering some, you know, some people from the news show, not big names, but, you know, sort of smaller actors, but still really lovely. A guy who was in Rogue One and who was in the new series of Doctor Who, and slowly, you know, getting on the map. And I just would like to build it so we have proper events. My partner is, there's a thing over in this village, right? And it's something to do with Northumberland men, right? That they seem to like to dress up as women. Now, I don't know if you get that over there, but it's like these very butch macho men who normally would look like they're going to headbutt you. Suddenly, every so often, if they get a chance to put a frock on, go really crazy with it. So Lisa said, what we should do is have Superhero Girl Day, you know, so that we can get lots of people in cosplay as all the Supergirls, you know, and sort of like allow these guys to just come out of themselves and dress as, you know, Batgirl or Wonder Girl or whatever they want to be. Anyway, so there'll be sort of things like that, you know. This is the long-term plan, anyway. And I've digressed again.
No, you are. You know, Derek said to me, you know, you're going to talk and he's going to talk and all of a sudden an hour will be gone. And if you look at the clock right now, that's exactly what the hell has happened.
I'm sorry. I'm gabbling. You know, I'll talk about it.
Apologize for this.
No, the museum, it's just, and the thing is, I was talking about price. You know, you go to sort of like the Doctor Who experience in Cardiff now, and it's, I don't know what the ticket price is, but it's something crazy. And if you've got, you know, I think because I came from a low, you know, a low money background, I just couldn't go to very many things. And I thought, I want to make sure everybody, no matter what income they're on, can get to see some of this stuff because it inspired me as a kid. Do you know what I mean? It was the thing that I could, I mean, obviously it wasn't original items, but in the magazines and things like Starburst magazine and Starlog and things, you would see these props and these monsters and they sort of fired my imagination. They really did. And they were a release, an imaginative, creative release. And I thought, right, I want everyone to be able to come here and see these things for real, you know, and give them that chance. And it won't be expensive. I'll have to charge just because I need to keep the place open and cover, you know, the bills and various things. But
you can also teach classes and have lectures there as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I thought about, you know, taking a couple of the props out to school. There's a comic artist. Well, there's a guy who came to our school recently, Kev, I'm trying to think, it's Kev Sutherland. And he's great. He's like a Doctor Who, really. And he does, I don't know if you've heard of a comic called The Beano. Do you know The Beano? It's a British... Right. It's one of the oldest comics, I think, running in existence. But it's a British one. And it's crazy humor. It's slapstick humor. And he's done this character called Dennis the Menace. And he's drawn Dennis on the cover for about, 10 years or so. But he's also done some Doctor Strange comics for Marvel. And he comes to schools now because he said it's actually very difficult for comic artists to, you know, to get a full-time living. You know, it's quite hard work getting the money in. Because that's one of the things I always wanted to do was be a comic artist. We had a serious chat about it. And he said the hard thing is at the minute is just getting, you know, unless you're in the big league, you know, it's a hard way to make a money, to a living at times. So he comes and does school workshops and he's wonderful. He really is. And he does, you know, you all create a comic within a day. And I just thought, well, I could do this with the props, using them as, you know, stimulus, either in science, you know, sort of technological ideas and, you know, sort of like take a creature in and you could think about the environment it might have evolved in, you know. And then likewise, of course, the art side is a natural thing, sculpting and mask making and things like that. So there's all sorts of options where to take this beyond where it is now, you know.
Well, I've got to tell you, Neil, I am so far away.
Yeah.
But I've got to find a way to come out and visit you.
You can see stay this here. Place. Come over when it's done. Just come over and we'll go out. And we'll
I'm
have a
telling
night.
You now. That I'm going to do that.
Hey, that'd be brilliant. That'd be amazing. Yeah, I'll be fantastic. And you're more than welcome, you know. And you could come and stay here, or we can put you up in something rather nicer than our house. Our house is a bit sort of gothic at the minute, and I'm being polite when I call it gothic. It's work in progress, should we say.
You know, life is a work in progress, and that's fine.
Absolutely.
I'm good with that.
Yeah.
Neil, I can't tell you what a pleasure it has been. And guys, I told you we were going to go for an hour, and we've kind of done that.
Sorry.
But we're going to have that. No, do not. Don't you dare be sorry. It was wonderful. When your Kickstarter begins, I want you to come back and talk to us about it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Coming up on Sci-Fi Saturday Night in the next couple of weeks, are some people. I wish I knew what they were, because I don't. And we'll get back to that because I know nothing else was the website. Sci-Fi Saturday Night is the official podcast of Redicon, Northeast Comic Con, BooksandBooks.com, and ComicArthouse.com. Visit ComicArthouse for some best deals on original art, dozens of big artists. This have a moment to take a look at Sci-Fi Saturday Night's and I believe you can only now on Amazon and Barnes&Noble.com. Original music was provided by Rob Watts. Find his creations at RobWattsOnline.com. Music was provided by Robin Wolfgang. Check out their groups, Lawrence Maybe Wright. Again, can't thank you enough. And we're going to hear more about this. Science as time goes on. Many thanks to Robert Cat for speaking quietly. And I apologize for that. From the Peabody Downtown, soon part of the Soundboard Creole, home to Fort Sumter. Thank you so much. There we go. And Java, thanks for all the fish. This is Dome saying Terry and Jeannie shared famous lesson, shared joy increased. Thus do we all achieve entropy. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody!